war crimes in the refugee camp in an effort to prevent future resistance and bringing down the Janina Brigades, the newly formed resistance group that's comprised of fighters from different Palestinian armed groups.
What really unites us here in the Jenin refugee camp is not the Palestinian groups, but what unites us is this refugee camp and family closeness. We all live here as one big family. We stand together against the Israeli occupation and against anyone hostile to us.
This is how those resistance fighters think. They are young men living in the camp. I can describe each one of them as a phoenix. They're brave young men insisting on the challenge with simple equipment, personal pistols, explosive devices, and they caused the Israeli occupation great losses.
Israeli military used drones, bulldozers, and hundreds of troops in its army operation as regime troopers hunted down fighters who had grown increasingly bold. Israeli officials thought the regime's military would succeed in breaking the safe haven of the camp. However, they were wrong.
During the Al-Aqsa Intifada, resistance was strong in the refugee camp. The camp has so long been a center for the resistance fighters. With the accumulations, all the raids and destruction and killings establish a struggle in the camp, a non-stop struggle. This means a generation lives and a new generation comes. They are people who reject humiliation and reject all forms of oppression. The residents know the path has always been thorny and difficult, but that's why the people of Jenin will always remain their spearhead in the face of the occupation.
Not only for its residents, but for all the Palestinians, the refugee camp with its warren of alleyways and dilapidated buildings adorned with banners bearing the portraits of martyrs will keep Palestinians recalling their pain and their long history of resistance and fighting. Despite the non-stop Israeli operations in the Jenin refugee camp, the camp continues to be considered a symbol of Palestinian armed resistance. Residents of the camp argue that the latest killings and destruction have not only failed to weaken the Palestinians' resolve, but also helped to increase their resistance and steadfastness. Mona Qandil, Occupy Jenin refugee camp.
The Muslim world has dealt with its fair share of natural disasters over the years, but few would have expected to see the sheer scope of devastation caused by a week of horror across North Africa. Earthquakes, floods, and natural wildfires consuming everything in their path and laying waste to the environment around them.
The first disaster was the horrific earthquake that hit Morocco, a 6.8 magnitude quake, which struck at around 11 p.m. local time on the 8th of September. Aftershocks followed on Wednesday the 13th, temporarily hampering rescue efforts there. At least 2,800 people were killed and over 300,000 people remain affected. 1 week on, and the humanitarian needs remain incredibly great there. Then there was Storm Daniel, which crashed down on Libya, leading to the collapse of two dams in the city of Derna. The United Nations said in a report released on Sunday that the death toll from the devastating floods that hit that Libyan city, well, that sits at around 11,300 people, although those figures are disputed, with at least another 10,000 people who have still remained missing there. Aid workers fear disease and other crises loom on the horizon, and that will likely add to the toll.
Moroccans continue to live in fear of the inevitable aftershocks while trying to dig through and recover the bodies of the many thousands still missing.
It's God's will. I was in the kitchen with my daughter-in-law while both my husband and my son were sleeping. When the roof fell on them, they were killed, trapped under the rubble, and nobody could save them. It was God's will.
The violent storms which battered Libya could have been more costly in human life than the tragedy in Morocco. As an entire city, Derna, was overrun, thousands again died in the raging waters, with some claiming the death toll could reach as high as 20,000.
We took the families from the first floor to the fourth floor, and then from here we saw the buildings drift. and we saw Derna completely immersed. In just 10 minutes, the city became submerged. At 5:30, as light came, Hamza and Malik went down to inspect the street, and they told us to come down from the second floor to the C Street and not to go out to the side of the valley. We went down and saw a terrifying sight. People are dead in the streets, cars are destroyed, and homes have collapsed.
The wildfires of Algeria have thankfully been less costly, with no reports of fatalities surfacing. This was the exact same region hit with fires in July, causing the deaths of at least 30 people. Despite these hardships and the immense trauma caused to the victims, these Muslim-majority countries consider these calamities a test of faith and endurance, a natural part of this life.
All the Egyptian people offer their condolences and express their grief to the people of Libya and Morocco. We are offering any assistance that we can provide. Egypt already sent support because the Egyptian people and military are willing to show solidarity with people all around the world, not just Arabs.
As the rescue efforts continue, Muslims across the globe have been sending not just charity, but their prayers too, in the hope of sending strength to the people most afflicted with these biblical-style disasters.
The first days of fall in Iran coincides with the reopening of schools after a three-month-long summer vacation. It marks the start of learning, finding new friends, and getting to read new books. Other than that, students say coming to school paves the way to reach their goals and dreams.
We all have goals that we must strive for. Coming to school is one of the steps that we must take to reach those goals. School provides us with an environment where we can use the lessons studied there to improve and succeed in university. I want to study architecture in university.
They say that even though giving up on their long summer vacation is hard, going to school for them means pursuing their desired future.
It's hard to give up on summer vacation, but I'm doing it to get what I want. I would like to study computer and programming in one of the best universities. I really like this field, and I think as a woman, I can achieve my goals. Why not? We have many women who have studied in the best fields and universities.
Melika is a student who has reached high academic achievements despite her young age. She is a young inventor.
I have an invention that can solve the sensory motor problem of patients with spinal cord injury. In addition, I have worked with various universities and medical students on the treatment of stomach cancer, which has been fruitful.
Iran, a country with high position in scientific rankings, owes many of its achievements to the boys and girls whose eagerness to learn has these days brought them to school. Farzan Ashurian, Tehran.
Israel has resealed its crossings with Gaza for the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, or Day of Atonement. There is pedestrian crossing in northern Gaza, and the Kerem Shalom commercial crossing in southern Gaza will remain shut until Tuesday. The closure of the crossings will only increase the suffering of more than 2 million Gazans who have been under a crippling blockade since 2007. The impoverished coastal sliver already suffers from high poverty and unemployment rates. Experts say that sealing the crossings during Jewish holidays will further complicate the situation and is part of Israel's racist policies against the Palestinians.
We strongly condemn this outrageous move. Israel uses Jewish holidays as a racist excuse to make the people of Gaza suffer and deprive them of their most basic rights. The goal of closing the crossings is to further tighten the blockade, destroy the economy, and to keep the people of Gaza as prisoners in a big prison.
Every year, the apartheid Israeli regime seals the crossings with Gaza for an average of 100 days for Jewish holidays and other occasions, while keeping its crossings with Egypt and Jordan open on the same occasions.
Israel has systematically closed the border crossings between Gaza and Israel, Erez and Kerem Shalom, which has inflicted more hardship and more burdens on the Gaza community. In the beginning of the Jewish holiday, that they close the border crossings with the Gaza Strip mainly, and they keep it open with other areas, like they keep their border crossing open with Egypt, with Jordan.
Experts believe that only the complete lifting of the inhumane Israeli siege and the permanent reopening of all crossings can end the deteriorating humanitarian situation in the tiny coastal territory.
Israel is suffocating the Gaza Strip with its inhumane policies. We demand the full lifting of the blockade and the permanent reopening of all crossings. Israel aims to harm the people of Gaza, including patients and workers, as much as it can, under any pretext it can find.
Tel Aviv's racist policy during Jewish holidays is considered by many as a grave violation of international laws and norms.
Israel says that it will keep the crossings with Gaza sealed during Jewish holidays for security reasons. But human rights groups reject Tel Aviv's argument, asserting that such measures are only aimed at tightening the blockade. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Iraq started its war on Iran 43 years ago today. In the beginning hours, Iraqi bombs rained down on military bases and airports of the Islamic Republic. Within a few hours, a retaliatory operation was planned by Iran's air forces, codenamed Kaman 99. A gathering was held in Tehran on Saturday to mark the anniversary of this operation during the Sacred Defense Week.
The Air Force, as a force with rapid reaction capacity, intervened in a critical situation and bombed the enemy's bases. The experts in the world believe that our Air Force is not capable of confronting the enemy, but 140 airplanes carried out this operation, along with other airplanes that took pictures of the enemy's headquarters.
Iraq deployed 192 warplanes to attack 10 bases and airports on the first day of the war. But Operation Kaman 99 destroyed Saddam's ominous dream of conquering Tehran in just 6 days.
This operation turned the Ba'athist forces' dream of conquering Tehran in 6 days into a bitter nightmare. After 3 days, the Iraqi Air Force had no ability to confront the Iranian Air Force. And from here, Iranian skies became safe and the ground for the liberation of Khorramshahr was prepared.
Participants in the event also talked about the West's intervention in the war in support of Iraq.
The Western countries supported Saddam to attack Iran with the aim of destroying the Islamic Revolution. Saddam initially attacked the Air Force because he knew how important they were.
This operation and other operations that took place during the 8 years of Saddam's imposed war against Iran show the strength and solidity of the Islamic Republic, which has been achieved by the committed and expert forces of the country. Tehran.
One year since the fatal shooting of Black Londoner Chris Cabba, the British police officer alleged to have shot him in the head has been charged with murder. The officer, who's been granted anonymity by a court order, is known by the codename NX121 and has been remanded in custody, which means he'll stay in jail until his court case, which is due to start next year. Mr. Cabba's killing sparked anti-government protests in the UK and once more shone the spotlight on persistent accusations of British police brutality and institutional racism. The Cabba family released a statement welcoming the news of the murder charge and reiterated their calls for justice to be served.
Chris was so very loved by our family and all his friends. He had a bright future ahead of him, but his life was cut short. Our family and our wider community must see justice for Chris. We welcome this charging decision, which could not have come too soon. Now we await the trial of the firearms officer without delay and hope and pray that justice will be served.
Chris Cabba was unarmed at the time of his killing, caused by a single bullet fired to the head by a police officer as he drove through the south of the British capital. His family have said many times they believe that if Chris was white, the police would have responded differently and that he'd still be alive today.
Chris, go!
Supporters say that while the charge is welcome, they must keep the pressure up to ensure some semblance of justice is served to Mr. Cabba's family. Stephanie Lightfoot Bennett's twin brother Liam Patterson was killed in police custody over three decades ago, and she's acutely aware of the process families have to go through in their fight for accountability.
In order for justice to be seen, and for the wider public, in order to feel safe with the history of the Met Police and the police in general, we need to keep this pressure up. We need to bring these officers and any future officers to book. The one way we can keep up pressure is to march and have our voices heard. Every last Saturday of October, United Families and Friends campaign march from Trafalgar Square at midday down Whitehall to Downing Street so the families' voices can be heard.
The charge of Officer NX121 will only renew the focus on Britain's security services, from long-standing charges of institutional racism, an epidemic of sexual assaults by police officers, and the ongoing persecution of journalists. Trust in the police force is at an all-time low, and as things stand, doesn't look like it will be restored among the public anytime soon. Issa Ali, London.
In the limelight.
According to the data from the Office for National Statistics, ONS, annual private rental prices surged by 5.2% in England, 6.5% in Wales, and 5.7% in Scotland. Within England, the highest annual percentage change in private rental prices was in the West Midlands, Yorkshire and the Humber, and London at 5.5%, while the Northeast saw the lowest increase at 4.6%. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, private rental prices paid by tenants in the UK have jumped by 5.3% in the 12 months leading up to July, marking the largest annual percentage change since records began in 2016. Data from the Office for National Statistics, ONS, has shown. The figure was up from 5.2% in the previous month, with costs consistently increasing over the past 2 years. According to the ONS, annual private rental prices surged by 5.2% in England, 6.5% in Wales, and 5.7% in Scotland. Within England, the highest annual percentage change in private rental prices was in the West Midlands, Yorkshire and the Humber, and London at 5.5%, while the North East saw the lowest increase at 4.6%. The ONS figures also showed house price growth slowing, rising 1.7% in the 12 months to June, down from 1.8% increase in May and well below the peak of 14% in July last year. According to the report, the average house price in the UK was £288,000 in June. Average house prices increased over the year by 1.9% to $391,000 in England, by 0.6% to $272,000 in Wales, and by 2.7% to $222,000 in Northern Ireland. House prices in Scotland stayed practically unchanged at an average of $241,000. The head of housing market indices at the ONS, Aminu said annual house price inflation measured using final transaction prices slowed again in June, but the fall was gentler than we have seen in previous months. The British housing market saw mortgage rates hitting a 15-year high last month due to a series of interest rate hikes by the Bank of England to curb inflation, which has sent demand plummeting. A key mortgage rate in the UK surged to its highest level in 15 years recently, exceeding the rate reached in the aftermath of a September mini-budget crisis. And that is according to figures from data provider Moneyfacts. The average two-year fixed residential mortgage rate jumped to 6.66% recently, narrowly exceeding the 6.65% touched last October. Mortgage costs in Britain are now at their highest since August 2008 during the financial crisis, when rates stood at 6.94%. The British housing market has slowed as soaring mortgage rates, driven by a series of interest rate hikes by the Bank of England to curb inflation, have sent demand plummeting. Concerns about a stickier-than-expected consumer price growth, which held at 8.7% in May, have led to a significant increase in the cost of funding, with fixed mortgage deal rates climbing in recent weeks. On top of the strains on the country's ailing housing market, the rate surge is sparking fears of a catastrophe for cash-strapped homeowners. Andrew Awesome, home director at Lloyds Banking Group, was quoted by Reuters as saying, "Undoubtedly, households and customers are feeling the effect of not just mortgage rates increasing, but the wider cost of living crisis." The BOE's latest rate hike of 0.5 percentage points to 5% would see 1.2 million British households, equivalent to 4% nationwide, run out of savings by the end of the year because of higher mortgage repayments, a study by the National Institute of Economic and Social Research showed. Matthew Ryan, head of market strategy at global financial services firm Ebori, said, "We suspect that higher mortgage rates will contribute to weaker economic activity in early 2024, and we are now not ruling out a technical recession in the first half of next year." He added that financial markets were pricing in a peak in UK interest rates of around 6.35% in the first quarter of 2024. According to Guardian, the average cost of renting a room in the UK has risen to more than £700 a month for the first time, according to data from the property website Spare Room. Experts said the data was proof of the housing market, that this market isn't working for anyone, and that rising rents meant tenants were stuck in unsuitable homes. The data from one of the UK's largest home-sharing websites shows that in the second quarter of this year, the average monthly cost of a room was £704, 17% higher than in the same period of 2022. The largest regional increases were in Northern Ireland, up by 20% year-on-year, closely followed by London and Scotland, both up by 19%. Spare Room's data showed rents had increased year-on-year in all the UK's 50 largest cities and towns, with the biggest rises in Edinburgh, up 25%, Middlesbrough, 21%, and Manchester, 20%. In London, room rents reached an average of £971 a month. This figure reflects rooms advertised via Spare Room that are typically in shared homes. They are in line with other surveys in recent months that have highlighted how sizable the rent rises are given the shortage of properties. The chief executive of Generation Rents, Benny Taumi, said rising rents on new tenancies mean renters face compromises like squeezing into smaller homes or moving further away from workplaces and family. He added that the dramatic rental rises also meant people were stuck in unsuitable homes that they can afford but would like to leave. In May, the estate agents Hamptons said the average new monthly rent outside London had passed £1,000 for the first time, and that tenants in Great Britain were typically paying 25% more than the start of COVID-19. Matt Hutchinson, a spare rooms director, said the housing market simply isn't working for anyone. Renters and homeowners are struggling, and landlords are continuing to leave the market. He added that although rents in London remained high, they had fallen slightly in June, the first time rents have decreased in capital in over a year, Hutchinson said. Nevertheless, for many people, housing will be the key issue for the next general election, so we need to hear something positive and practical from all parties in the coming month. Sticking plaster policies isn't enough. We need real commitment to fixing this housing crisis.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
France has the largest Muslim population in Europe, nearly 6 million people, and for a country holding that record, it is not treating its Muslim population with respect. The most recent instance being the French government banning French athletes wearing the hijab at the Paris Olympics next year. Well, this move has received wide-scale condemnation, including by the UN. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why France is enacting such restrictions on Muslim women and whether there is a pattern by France in discriminating against Muslims altogether. First, let me introduce our guests. Anthony Hall, professor of globalization at Lethbridge University, joins us from Lethbridge. Also joining us is Fahima Mohamed, who's a broadcaster and executive coach, who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. I'll start with you first, Anthony Hall. The incident, as we understand it, the French government banning French athletes for wearing the hijab at the Paris Olympics. Now, this is what the French sports minister has said in an explanation from him. He's in favor of a, quote, strict regime of secularism applied rigorously in the field of sport. And my question to you, aside from your reaction to this, is isn't that in itself, this stance, a form of discrimination?
Well, discrimination is a tricky word. I think the word that I'd like to see put front and center is secularization and certainly Islamophobia. Now, to me, the quintessence of Islamophobia was concocting this 9/11 event to make it seem that radical Muslims did it because they hated the freedoms of the West. It was a concocted job, an Israeli Zionist-led job, 9/11. So this Islamophobia that infects people's minds has been engineered and created. Now, this word secularization, we're talking about France here. France had a little something called the French Revolution in 1789, which was largely about secularization, overthrowing the divine right of monarchs and the clergy. And so the West has developed this. Some see the Communist Revolution as a sort of outgrowth of the French Revolution. And the Communist Revolution was about, you know, secularization, materialism, that the main way that humans define and negotiate their relationships has to do with economics and material relations. So this secularization that is being demonstrated here and the obsessions of those who want to take it beyond the point of respecting fellow human beings, but imposing some kind of doctrinaire principle that they believe in terms of dress or how you do schooling or what you wear at the Olympics, all of that is, you know, we need to put this in context.
Well, thanks for putting it into context, but I'm going to take the context and background info that you gave to us, which is really appreciated, and put it much more simpler to you, Fahima Mohammed, in terms of, let's say you are an athlete, you're a Muslim, you believe in the hijab, and you're very good at, let's say, archery or, let's say, swimming, and you have a very promising future in that field, enough to qualify for the Olympics. But you can't go to the Olympics if you're a French Muslim because of this, I guess, ban that the government, the French government, feels is necessary. How would that make you feel? Tell us what a person in those shoes is feeling.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think that it's quite obvious to a lot of women generally that when they are told what to wear, it's definitely infringing upon an individual choice and freedom, and it's also an oppression. I think as history shows that there's lots of dictatorship around the fact that when you want to control a particular sector or society, then you will actually, you know, pick on something like, you know, trying to challenge what someone wears and dictate that. So I think it's a much wider, very, very alarming message that's been sent across. Even though French has its, you know, fundamental principle of secularism, it shouldn't really infringe upon individual choices, as well as, you know, disregard the inclusivity of spiritual, sort of like international sporting events. Because in the spirit of sport, it should really be wide and open to everyone. And we all have our individual choice. And even if it's under a certain rule, I think, it's more of a dictatorship as well as an oppression to a particular group. So it's definitely worrying, and it's definitely something that we need to review a lot closer and see how this unfolds, because it is targeting a particular group, and it really is not sort of in line with the values of the West or, you know, the UN in general.
Well, France seems to be very focused on the Muslim community, as it should, but maybe for all the wrong reasons, Anthony Hall, when it passes a law such as this anti-separatism law, which has been criticized widely for singling out Muslims. One of the things that it does, intervening in mosques and associations responsible for their administration, as well as controlling the finances of Muslim-affiliated associations and non-governmental organizations. Why does France feel that it has to pretty much control mosques in that respect when it comes to Muslims?
Well, I believe that this obsession with secularization that I introduced, you know, has a lot to do with it. Now, I heard my fellow presenter here talk about individual rights, that the individual rights of Muslims are being infringed. But then there's a discussion of group rights and treating all members of a group in a discriminatory way. So this is a big deal in the West, this group right versus individual right, and how do we balance the two? If the position is, like, say you go to war with France, it's conceivable that Muslims will join the French military. Should the French military be open to distinct forms of uniforms for Muslims in the French army? Let's move it away from the Olympics. I'm just trying to advance a discussion here and think this through.
Well, I mean, that. What do you think about that analogy there, Fahimi, first of all? Because there's different venues in the, you know, in the case of a war, or the military, I should say. I think that that would be a unique one. I don't know if that fits into the conversation. What do you think?
Well, I'd like to think of it as a different sort of sense. At the end of the day, for example, international human rights standards emphasizes that the restrictions on religious expression should be minimal and justifiable under a specific circumstance. And France, you know, strict regulations on religious attire, including the bikini ban, for example, may raise questions whether or not these restrictions meet international criteria. And I don't think that they are addressing this on that level from the UN's perspective. And it's just been out there to say under the umbrella of secularism, but it does actually infringe even on the UN standards of human rights. So when you look at it, as much as you say group or individual, regardless, I think we need to question, you know, where do we have those boundaries and lines when it comes to the human rights standards?
Why should there be such boundaries and lines, Anthony, when it comes to Muslims? I mean, another one of these things based on the separatism law that I'm looking at, which is pretty unbelievable, is that it restricts the educational choices of Muslims by making homeschooling subject to official permission. Would you allow that to happen to your family if you were a Muslim?
Well, I think this is a very good place to dig into this issue, because homeschooling is much being discussed in Canada right now, because schooling is doing a transgender experiments, trying to convince young people that they should change their genders, trying to persuade them that they need surgery to be mutilated, that they need hormones and such. And Muslims here in Canada are leading the rejection of this. And people are facing this crisis in Canada wanting homeschooling. And I'm wondering if homeschooling might be the place to say to the French government, well, if you are, you know, so obsessed with, you know, being secular and conformist and violating our human rights to express ourselves as individuals and a group, what about if the Muslim community in France became organized to say, well, we're going to do our own schooling? And we want, you know, our percentage of the tax money recompensed to us for, you know, some support in our schooling. And so we don't really want to be part of your school system. We would like to have our own homeschooling, which we could organize in a small way or a large way. And we'll live and let live in that way. We don't like the way you're forcing your majoritarian control of the French government on us, which is a very significant part of France. But since you're insisting on doing these horrific things to us, we want to have our own schools. And we want to raise our children not in a woke way, you know, this woke thing about forcing you know, homosexual, gay, lesbian things on that doesn't wash well with Muslims, as we can see here in Canada. I'm sure it's the same in France. So how about being a little bit assertively separatist with the government of France and saying, let us develop our own education then, since you're, you know, we don't agree with your type of education. That's what we're asking. And you know, we have to share a country here. I believe that a number of Muslim people there are probably committed to being citizens of France and making a go of it in France, but we need adaptations.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
That sounds like at least a proposition there, Fahima Mohamed, if I'm not mistaken, something that perhaps can be contemplated. But when it comes to this French president, I believe that it was just years ago when he said Islam is in a crisis, Muslims need to be reformed, even the clerics need to go through schooling in order to adhere to the type of Islam that the French president and his state thinks should be exercised in his country. I don't know if he's going to stand up for Muslims standing up against the government in terms of having a budget passed for them. I mean, what does the French president not realize what he's saying and the impression he makes when he says clerics need to be reformed and Islam needs to be reformed? I mean, I'm not going to say that's a blasphemy, but that is very offensive given a Muslim to hear those words.
Absolutely. It's a belief system that has been concocted. And at the end of the day, it also shows that it's more of a state control that he's trying to, you know, sort of place France under instead of the sort of democratic sort of like society and state that every sort of Western country sort of tries to sort of say that keeps them apart from, you know, backward or other countries. So what they are exercising is it's sort of the same sort of way as they would scrutinize sort of, you know, the East, for example, when they are doing it just because of they choosing to have the other end of the extreme. So I think that we need to be very, very concerned about the way in which we're seeing France to be more of a dictatorship, as well as trying to target certain groups, and especially the Muslims in particular, and having a state control where they not even giving parents a right to educate their own children, and they have to be involved even in the home. So that is very worrying, and it's really no different to any other maybe communist country or dictatorship or autocratic system. So I think that if they can do that and successfully do that with one group, they can definitely do that with someone else. So even if you're not implied and part of the umbrella of Islam or Muslims, then if they can successfully do it there, then other groups and other religious parties or other sort of like communities should also be worried if, you know, they're going to be targeted next in the same way.
Indeed. All right, let's get your thoughts on this European Islamophobia report conducted in the year 2022. If I may ask you there, Anthony Hall, some of the findings, I'm going to begin with one. If you are a French Muslim applying for a job, you are 5 times more likely to face discrimination than a non-Muslim. The same types of findings were found for housing for Muslims and also for police brutality. So the big question is, in a country like France that houses or has the most number of Muslims in Europe, why is it that there's Islamophobia to the scale that we're seeing based on this report?
And why does France have the most Muslims in Europe? I mean, the fact is, this is really deeply rooted in history with Algeria especially. And there was a point at which France actually treated Algeria as part of France and essentially demeaned the human rights and citizenship of indigenous Algerians, who are mostly Muslims. So this oppression of Muslims is you know, very deep-rooted. It's part of a consistent package. France colonized, you know, much of Africa and is facing that. You know, the United States is facing the poverty of this secular approach to the max. Where you know, we become without principles, without ethics, without values, without respect for the rule of law and such. So this has to be confronted, the depth of this.
Well, the confrontation comes with gear. By gear, I mean the type of gear the Muslims wear. And Fahim Mohamed, that findings that I reported in this, or that I just relayed, in this report that was done on Islamophobia in Europe, of which France was the case study, one of the things regarding employment, it said if you are a Muslim woman wearing a headscarf, you have a 1% chance of finding employment. Why is this Muslim gear so much a thorn or a piece of, or an issue for, at least in France? 2004, it banned headscarves. 2010, it passed the ban on full-face veils. We're looking at 2023, the abaya, there was a ban on that. And now, of course, our news piece that we began with in terms of the swimwear. Why does the Muslim gear on women even an issue to pass laws banning them?
I think there's multifaceted reasons for it. Obviously, the actual ban itself is such a disparity which contradicts the principles of equality and fairness. And also whereby they're getting away with it because the EU and the UN are, and have a role to play with regards to addressing discrimination within any member states and ensuring that the EU adhere to principles of religious freedom and non-discrimination, you know, being essential. And I guess that we're targeted generally across the globe because we are very strong in our faith and we don't conform. And if there are agendas that are being put out there, with regardless whether it's in education or anywhere else, it's always out of fear and threat because we are the one long-standing, very wide sort of religion that is ever so much growing in numbers across the globe, as well as we are still strict and adhere to our sort of religious views and ways. But at the same time, we are still able to be quite successful in the West and still conform and integrate. And maybe that is seen as a threat. There could be many reasons for it, to sort of, you know, dumb us down or, you know, to control and to dictate because, you know, obviously there's power within the way in which we believe, feel and act. And we're not easily swayed by even, you know, this wokeness or feminism or anything that people even in the West, you know, under even secularism or non-religion may even find a problem. Whereas with us, it's already embedded in stone in our traditions and our cultures and our beliefs.
Anthony Hall, our guest there talks about the UN and the EU. It's worth mentioning that they as institutions need to somewhat be more proactive when it comes to Muslims in general, in this case with France and the laws that it has enacted. Why why have they shortchanged Muslims, but why are they not being more vociferous even, let alone act on it?
Well, there's a political reality here that I think I would like to address from the West. There's an understanding that the Jewish supremacy in the government of Biden, and, you know, it's in all the Western countries, has become sort of intolerable, that we have no say in our own government anymore. And let's just consider, what about the Muslim migration into Israel? Isn't that happening? Aren't they sort of supposed to be liberal, democratic Israel? No, there is no Muslim immigration into Israel. And yet Israeli agents and people like Soros are enforcing this rule on Europe that there must be open immigration of largely Muslims from Africa and such, into, you know, Germany and the EU countries. And you know, this is creating a backlash among Western people, largely white people, like you could say indigenous European people. And it's not totally to be dismissed as just bigotry and racism and such. Like, why is it that Israel needs to have an ethnic rule so that Israel is for Jews and to develop that culture, but the same doesn't apply to Europeans or North Americans. In the United States, there's a totally open border with people coming from all over the world flocking without going through any vetting process into the United States. This immigration thing and what is behind it, like the financing of George Soros, you know, very well-known agents of a Zio-American empire, you know, which is failing. Christianity is not a success story these days, and it's under assault. And it's definitely that the people pushing this woke agenda have special animosity towards white Christians. So the fact that this is unfolding in this way, now there's Macron trying to play all sides. He's an obvious Rothschild shill. And, you know, he is representing that faction, as, you know, EU is to represent that banking cartel. So the usual suspects that we can talk about on press TV, but somebody like me, it's hard to talk about it on Western media. We don't have opening for this kind of discussion in Western media. So right. I think it's incumbent upon folks in the theocracy of Iran, for instance, to, you know, consider what we're going through in the West.
Sure. Well, one of the things that's pretty amazing when it comes to this whole Islamophobia and anti-Islam sentiment, if you agree, Fahima Mohammed, is the fact that you have many politicians in Europe who are their platform, part of it is anti-Islam, and they promote that, and then they have followers, and they have a lot of supporters that way. Who can we blame there, or what can be blamed there? Is it because it's a product of the society and the way that anti-Islam sentiment is maybe promoted through either the culture, through media, what have you, or is it that they feel threatened by Muslims in any shape or form? What do you think?
I think it's a little bit of everything that you suggested, and I do think there's an agenda in mainstream media to promote certain minority groups within certain faiths in order for everyone to, you know, be the sheep that they've got following with regards to having one narrative about, you know, for example, Muslims. And that's why when anyone sees a Muslim, the first thing they say is, you know, either terrorist or oppressive or, you know, anything like that, because it's been subliminal messages for decades in the media with regards to it, and, you know, even probably even beyond 9/11. And at the end of the day, that was just the jump start where you've got a real excuse now for, you know, promoting this kind of material. And that's all people see when they see Muslims, and their voices are never really generally heard. And the norm and, you know, the everyday people and the ones that are working and integrating and living for generations are not necessarily being heard or spoken to. And even if they stand up for the same rights and the same values as everybody else, they're not looked upon as, you know, as equal in that way or even seen in that way. If anything was to go wrong, Muslims are also the first to condemn certain things, but you're never going to see that. So yes, media is powerful, and but the thing is, we are moving away from that with other platforms that are coming up and seeing. But obviously, if you've already got a belief, you're going to follow what you're going to follow, and you're going to jump on that bandwagon. So it's very easy. So until, you know, criminalizing Islamophobia is going to be an idea considered as criminal offense akin to anti-Semitism, then yeah, we might have some sort of way, but we need more leaders. We need more. Obviously, we've got, you know, powerful countries, unfortunately, that are not even on our sides, even if they claim to be Muslims, for example, you know, in the Middle East. So then we do have a political problem within our own sort of Muslim communities as well for not actually being on the side that we need for our own people. So there is a wider conversation beyond just France at the moment.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Fahima Mohammed, broadcaster and executive coach from London. Anthony Hall, thank you. Professor of Globalization, Lethbridge University from Lethbridge. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Ikoba Tawai and the team.